Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a not-for-profit community credit union now open in downtown Bellevue, serving members at their newest branch at the corner of Northeast 2nd and 108th Avenue Northeast. More information at WSECU.org.
I grew up on Capitol Hill in the 1970s and 80s, and then I moved away, but I stayed a lifelong Sonics fan that whole time.
You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is actor Ben Weber. He's been in movies like Kissing Jessica Stein and shows like Sex and the City, but he's also gotten attention for his love of Seattle's dearly departed NBA team. We talked over Skype.
I remember when the Sonics would play, I would play this game, this basketball game that was on my early PC to sort of predict the Sonics victory that later that day. There was this church like a couple blocks away from me on Capitol Hill, and sometimes it had a really low hoop, like a dunk hoop, and I'd go there and reenact some of the highlights from the games afterwards. And so it was this thing that was all the time everywhere.
At that time, how familiar were you with the name Howard Schultz?
I remember when I was at college, my grandmother would send me coffee beans from Starbucks. I remember getting to New York and telling people that I was like, okay, get ready. Starbucks is coming, people.
So you were an early adopter when it came to Starbucks, really?
I mean, God damn it. Yes, I was. I was like trying to be a cool kid.
And did you connect Starbucks to the Sonics? I mean, did it occur to you that this was the same guy? Is that obvious?
Yes. I started to put those pieces together. And I was like, boy, that's weird. This guy from Brooklyn goes to Seattle and then he buys the team. I'm like, okay, sure. What could possibly go wrong?
So let's fast forward to when something did go terribly awry. Yeah. What do you remember about learning about the transaction?
Well, Schultz said that he was going to keep the team there, and then he sold them to this concern from Oklahoma City, who made this really lame attempt to keep the team there and keep the fans happy. But it was very clear very early on, it was never going to stay in Seattle, Oklahoma City. We were screwed.
When it became clear that that's what was in the offing, that Seattle was going to lose its team, how did that feel to you?
So in a weird way, it was great to be not in Seattle. I was like, well, I'm already, you know, I should just grow up anyways. Like, I can't be a Sonics fan forever, but you just can't change this. You know, you're just hardwired, and it sucked. It really, really sucked.
How did you decide that you weren't going to just take this line down?
Well, I was just like, I'm going to make a video, and it's going to be sort of a call to action, and I'm going to sort of just talk about how I really feel.
I hate Howard Schultz, the owner of Starbucks. Every time I go into a Starbucks and I find a copy of his book, Onward, I rip out the table of contents and I use it to clog the toilet. Okay, I don't actually do that.
I wanted people to, like, you know, rip down the drywall, just destroy the place. That's probably a bad idea and I could probably get in a lot of trouble. So I was like, we'll just start very small.
But every time I go into a Starbucks, I always ask for an extra straw that I do not need and I throw away upon exiting the store. It's a small thing, but I think it's starting to get to Howard Schultz.
And hopefully, store by store, you know, we'd be able to take him down. And, you know, maybe he would do the right thing and get basketball back in Seattle again. And I'm still holding out hope that that could happen.
What has been the reaction beyond your circle of friends and family?
You know, it didn't go maybe it's quite as viral as I had hoped. But I feel like the people who were in the right places saw it, and I don't know, I felt vindicated. You know, unfortunately, Starbucks doesn't release information about its straws and how they're used to the consumers, so it's really hard to know how hard we were hitting them, but I can imagine, you know. I bet there's a lot of low-level employees that were refilling straw canisters that were like, you know, where the hell are these things going?
And they're sweating in the boardroom over this, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, they're having emergency meetings. I mean, you could tell. They're hurting.
I love coffee. I love tea. I love the Jaffa Jive and it loves me. coffee and tea and the java and me. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup.
Today on Sound Effect, our theme is Last Straw. Even if not everyone takes the term quite as literally as Ben Weber, we've all confronted that breaking point where something just has to give. This next story is about a woman at the end of a rope and a group of people whose time has run out. Homeless encampments are a regular sight when you drive along I-5. And for Linda Lowe, they've been part of her everyday life. She's a retired Tacoma firefighter who now lives in Seattle's Wallingford neighborhood, pretty close to I-5. And over the past year, two homeless encampments have sprung up right behind Linda's backyard, just past her bushes. But the world looks very different from either side of Linda's hedge. Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing talked with the homeowner and with the residents of an illegal encampment as the city was evicting them. First, let's meet Linda.
Linda Lowe is the person who you want to show up if you get hurt or find yourself in a dangerous situation. She would know exactly what to do. She's a retired Tacoma firefighter and paramedic. She's soothed the mentally ill, and she's steadied chronic alcoholics who were going through withdrawal. She made a conscious effort to get to know all of the people in her care.
I would take people to the hospital in the back of the medic unit and actually talk to them and try to get their stories, because everybody arrives where they are, if they're homeless, for a reason. You have a story for what you are in society, you know, so do I. So everybody does. And some of these people were just great people, you know, and things had happened that were unfortunate in their background. So that's why they were where they were.
After Linda retired, she moved into a small house in Seattle's Wallingford neighborhood that used to belong to her late uncle. Linda was surprised to find people similar to those she had helped on the job, setting up camp behind her home.
There's a level of anxiety having a homeless camp on the other side of my hedge. It gets higher as the garbage grows.
The first camp started out with a few tents, and then it grew. Linda says it was clean and tidy for a while, but then clothes, wet sleeping bags, old food, it all started to pile up. And from certain rooms in her house, she can see a lot.
I stood and watched a guy out there cooking a drug and then injecting it. And then one day, he apparently had just gotten up. It was probably 8:30, 9 in the morning, and was urinating.
Along with the drugs, the needles, the human waste, and the trash building up against her back hedge, there were fires. Loud shouts and screams would sometimes wake Linda up at 3 in the morning. She made multiple calls to the city. When the situation reached a critical health and safety problem, the camp was removed. Then, a few months later, new people moved in.
The first man decided to put a tent out there. So I did go out and I told him he couldn't camp there. And he said he could if he wanted to, and that was it.
Again, when the conditions reached a crisis, the camp was cleared out. The empathy and compassion that Linda once had for the homeless is being replaced by frustration.
I've actually kind of given up.
The city of Seattle estimates it has more than 400 illegal encampments. These are not single tents. They're clusters of people living outside in all sorts of scenarios, on sidewalks, grassy triangles of land that break up busy intersections, and along bike paths like the Burke Gilman. So we're talking almost 2,000 people. And yes, there's an ongoing debate of whether to just flat out leave these encampments alone or to remove them. We're not wading into those waters right now. The fact is, the city is removing sites like the ones that have popped up behind Linda's house, the camps that pose the most danger, the camps that are a threat to public health. A navigation team made up of police officers, social workers, and sanitation crews carries out the cleanups. The team also does a lot of outreach, visiting illegal sites across the city, trying to connect the homeless with social services. One of the team's leaders is Seattle Police Sergeant Eric Sir.
I always kind of think back that there's kind of two sides. There's the mercy and the justice. And the city's really trying to figure out how to balance those two things.
The extreme end of mercy would be to leave the tents alone, let people camp where they want. And justice?
You could arrest a lot of people for the things that they do, and you say, hey, you're trespassing, you can't do it, and if you don't move, boom, we just put you in jail.
On the day I meet Sergeant Zur, about a dozen tents are being taken down under the viaduct just across the street from the ferry terminal. All around us, clothes, radios, blankets, shoes, people's lives, it's all spilling out onto the sidewalk. Human feces is ground into the cement, Gatorade bottles are filled with urine. And then I spot a small bit of beauty, a healthy potted plant someone has taken care of in the midst of all this chaos. A removal, a sweep, a clear out, whatever you want to call it, it can't happen unless there is housing or shelter space the city can offer people. Members of the navigation team approach tents bearing fresh bananas and orange juice to help coax people outside so a plan can be worked out on where they can go. Bill and his partner, who didn't want to talk, are packing up.
This is our fourth time, so in 2 years, kind of sucks. It seems like the city just doesn't care. I'm a journeyman painter. I work seasonal. And I can't afford an apartment all year round. So if we had some affordable housing, we wouldn't be doing this.
A woman makes her way over to talk to us. Her cheekbones are purple with bruises. She goes by the name Sassy. She says one of the reasons why she and others have set up tents here is because it's close to places where they can get help. The Union Gospel Mission and Peter's Place, two social service organizations, are walking distance from here.
That's the only right place these people get resources. And when you move us from place to place to place to place, we're having to redo our resources all over again. And it's just a monotonous merry-go-round. The only way to ever end this is if they quit moving us, give us a stable camp where people can stay situated that's working on their housing. It's the only way to fix it, because otherwise you're just going to keep on throwing away a bunch of money to a bunch of homeless people that needed that stuff, and then they're going to go to another place to go get that stuff all over again. It just don't make sense.
Seattle is spending $65 million on homelessness this year. The city doesn't have a rundown of how much a removal like this one costs. Removal costs for last year are still being calculated and are expected to be released in a few weeks. The difficulty of people living in this situation and what they're having to do right now is not lost on Sergeant Sir.
It's hard to move, and it's hard to organize your stuff and to kind of go through this.
A man who goes by the name Moses watches his tent being crunched in the back of a trash truck. He walked away from most of his belongings. He also said no to shelter. But before heading out on his bicycle that's wrapped with Christmas lights to find a new campsite, he comes up behind Sergeant Sir.
He doesn't come down here with a chip on his shoulder or a grudge. He actually, he's humanity in his heart. He's one of the few left out there.
If you didn't catch that, Moses said Sergeant Sir has humanity in his heart. Yes, Sergeant Sir is in charge of clearing out this site, but the people who have to go don't seem to hold it against him. And the folks who turn down shelter this time, like Moses, maybe they'll say yes next time they cross paths with the familiar faces of the team. Since the navigation team has been doing this work, it's made direct contact with about 1,800 people, including the folks who set up tents behind Linda Lowe's house in Wallingford. I take a walk with Linda behind her home. She's considering putting up a very tall fence so that she doesn't have to rely on her laurel hedge to provide privacy. Afternoon rush hour is underway on I-5. Even though the earth behind her house was scraped bare by a backhoe during the last cleanup, there are still needles on the ground.
Yep, there's one without a tip on it. Yeah. I don't know what that is.
Oh, that's a dime bag of something.
Is it?
I'm just guessing, but maybe meth or something.
Oh, God, probably. Who knows?
Back inside, after spotting the small bag of drugs and those needles, Linda says she knows that many people who are homeless are battling with an addiction. Her own nephew fought hard to overcome an opioid addiction. He struggled, like the man Linda saw shooting up behind her house. While her well of patience is at rock bottom, Linda still has the urge to reach out.
You know, on Christmas, I actually considered making maybe some hot chocolate or something and taking it back there. I considered it.
But then she thought, no, doing something like that would only encourage them to stay.
That story from Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. So far, no new tents have appeared behind Linda's house, but that is not the case for the site under the viaduct. Once that area was cleared, new tents reappeared there in just a matter of days. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is The Last Straw. When Seattle writer Tim Haywood was growing up in Auburn, he had one of those moments where life took a turn. He was in elementary school, and he was overweight. He was the fat kid in class. Most of the time, that wasn't really an issue, except when it came to gym.
We had weighing and measuring day, and the boys and girls were together, even. And so you would line up by alphabetical order. And I remember this girl, Janice, was right in front of me. And she weighed, I don't know how tall she was, but she weighed 36 pounds. This is in second grade. So they're like, Janice, 36, you know, Cheryl, 56, Tim, 110. I mean, I got teased a lot, you know, all the names, fatty 2x4. So I managed to compensate a little bit. I developed a sense of humor. I got kind of good at imitating people, and my best imitation was of Richard Nixon, but I'm not going to even try that now. No. Oh, God. I want to make this perfectly clear. I'm not a crook. Kissinger's a crook. I'm not a crook. Spiro Agnew? What kind of a name is Spiro? Sounds like a yo-yo. By the time I was in fourth grade, when I was 10, there was a big project in King County, a big public works project called Forward Thrust. And part of that was they built pools in a lot of towns, these big, nice pools. And I think part of the funding was also they would bring kids in for swimming lessons, or like a swimming unit. We're sitting in class, and my teacher, Mr. Van Epps, he said, hey, I think you guys are all going to be really excited about this new unit we're going to do. You're going to love this. We're all going to go swimming. And I'm like, what did he say? Did he say we're going to go trimming or skimming? Or he didn't say swimming, right? I felt like dead man walking. I was just dreading it, just completely dreading it. So the day rolled around and we got to the pool and, you know, I'm looking around and people are looking at me. I could tell they were looking at me, but because, oh, there's Tim without his shirt on. Whoa, you know, my parents hadn't even seen me with my shirt off probably for 5 years. And a little side note, I didn't know how to swim either. So I get to the front of the line finally, and there's this really nice kid. He's a high school kid in the water. He's like, hey, my name's Ed, you know, come on in. It's nice and warm. And I get in and he's like, so do you know how to swim? And I shook my head, I said, no. He's like, oh, okay, well, do you know how to float? I'm like, I don't know. And he's like, oh, you just do this. And he showed me effortlessly how to float on your stomach, right? So I'm like, all right, I'll give that a try. And so I bent down and I'm like, wow, I'm actually floating. I guess I know how to swim. So I, you know, stand back up and Ed's like, no, you got to lift your legs up too. You can't stand there. I didn't even realize I was standing. And he said, you know, you'll be a beginner, nothing to be ashamed of, right? He's like, so go ahead and get out of the pool. And I couldn't really go back to where I got in because that was where the ladder was and it's where the kids were lined up. So I had to go off to the other side. And I got to the edge and I wasn't able to use my arms to lift myself out of the water and onto my knees on the side. So I just sort of put a knee up and slapped my chest on the ledge and kind of squirmed up. And I kind of slithered sideways like a walrus sunning itself a little bit. I looked across the pool where the line of kids were and they were just like giggling and like, you know, kids tell secrets with their mouths to the, you know, someone's ear and pointing a little bit. And I was just like, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. I legitimately wanted to cease to exist. I wanted to die at that point. I'm done. I've got to change. You know, you think you're hiding it. You think you're keeping it all inside when you get home. But my mom could tell there was something wrong with me. And so she's like, well, what's wrong? And I'm like, I must have just fessed up. I'm like, you know, that was the worst thing that's ever happened. She's like, well, you know, I heard about this new thing called Weight Watchers. And I think she'd been doing some research for me. So the closest Weight Watchers was at this VFW hall in Kent. And I lived in Auburn. So yeah, my mom would take me every Tuesday night to the VFW hall. And it was me and about 30 stay-at-home moms. Every week I would wear the pants that I wore the first time I went so that I could tell how much weight I'd been losing. Every night after Weight Watchers, I got to eat any kind of food I wanted. And I'm not sure that's a good thing to reward someone with food who's on Weight Watchers, but my mom would take me to Taco Time or Triple X or A&W for one awesome meal a week. And then the rest of the time I'm eating really healthy vegetables and fruits and, you know, lean meats. And I would eat that. And then I'd say, Mom, I'm still hungry. And she'd say, no, remember, your brain has to have 5 minutes before it realizes that you're full. And I'm like, yeah, okay. And it did. It did. So finally I reached my goal. I lost 15 pounds and I got to go up front and get this pin, and I got a standing ovation from the stay-at-home moms as I held up my my jeans, my old jeans. So I had to learn to swim and went back to the same forward thrust pool, the same terrible, you know, Pavlov's dog reaction of going in there and smelling the chlorine and freezing up and not thinking I'd be able to do anything. I learned to swim, I learned to backstroke, and on the last day, they let you dive off the high dive into the deep water. And I did it. It was a strange feeling because the first time you go into deep water and you don't feel your feet hit anything, it's sort of helpless, but then you bob up and it's sort of empowering as you're watching yourself and feeling yourself float and swim and go to the side. I'm like, wow, I did it. The next school year, fifth grade, I kept the weight off and did the same swim test and made the intermediate group, not the beginners, not the advanced, but the intermediate group. So the older I get, the more I realize that 10-year-old fat kid is the guy I aspire to be. If I'm ever feeling sorry for myself or feeling just self-pity or saying, you know, you're just, you know, you can't do this, you can't do that, I just tap into the kid who was in the locker room and was humiliated and resolved to never have that happen again.
Tim Haywood is a writer who lives in West Seattle. That story was produced by Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5. Our theme today is The Last Straw. So do me a favor, picture Sasquatch. For me, it's a very specific image. It's a big, hairy humanoid, mid-stride, arms swinging, head turned to glance back over its right shoulder. It's an iconic picture. And the thing that Bigfoot was turning back to look at was Bob Gimlin. Gimlin, along with Roger Patterson, gathered their famous film footage in Northern California in 1967. 50 years later, people still pore over it, debating its authenticity and speculating on how it might have been faked. Well, that film, which launched 1,000 Bigfoot hunters, also ruined Bob's life. Bob Gimlin lives in Yakima. He's a man of many interests, it's just that most of them have to do with horses.
This is the old stud horse. He's an old timer. Step on the outside. Step out.
We are at a friend's farm in Yakima where Bob keeps most of his horses. He's spent decades making his living around animals.
This old sleigh here, I'd hook Kilargo, that stallion, when he was young, to this sleigh and give the kids rides in here.
Bob is a real deal cowboy. He used to break horses. He rode in an honest to God sheriff's posse. And of course, he rode in rodeos, when he was young at least. He's 86 now.
I quit rodeoing altogether in 1958 and enjoyed rodeo, and that's where I met Roger Patterson at the rodeos.
Bob and Roger hit it off. But then after Bob quit the circuit, they didn't see each other for a few years, until one day in 1961.
I stopped at my uncle's service station down in Union Gap, and the guy walked out, and it was Roger.
As they caught up, Roger told Bob he wanted to show him something. He came back with a large plaster cast of a footprint, a big footprint. Well, Bob wasn't sure what to make of that, but he was open-minded enough that one day later, when Roger came knocking, he was willing to listen.
So he come running into my place, and he said, "Bob, can you take me to Northern California?" And I said, "Well, can't do it now." Well, he said, Labor Day weekend, they found all these tracks down there if they come back to work.
Bob agreed to load up three horses in his trailer and head down to the area around Willow Creek in Northern California. The two men mounted up and headed deep into the woods on old logging roads.
The leaves were all changing, reds and yellows, and it was pretty rugged, you know, it was hills like that. We were just riding up there, and Roger was taking pictures of me on the horse and leading the pack horse. That's when Roger's horse started just the jumping and the lunging. And I could see that there's something going on there. I look over there, and there's a Bigfoot standing just on the other side of the creek from us. But he just immediately turned, started walking away. Well, Roger, by then, had got his camera out of the saddlebag on his horse, and he was up running across the creek there. He hit the other side of the bank and stumbled and kind of fell down on his elbows. And that's when it made that famous head turn. It's when I stepped down off the horse. My mind thought, well, yeah, these things really do exist after all this I heard about them and stuff. And I've been wanting to see a track. Here's one walking right away from me, right in front of me here.
There was no doubt in Bob's mind. This was no hoax. This was Bigfoot. Once they'd calmed their horses down, they tried to follow her. She appeared to be a rather heavy-bosomed female, but to no avail.
And then we talked about the smell and different things and musky, skunky smell. And Roger said, "Oh, it smelled like an old dog that rolled in cow." And I said, "Well, yeah, maybe that."
Once the shaky footage was developed, Roger was giddy. He was sure he had a gold mine on his hands. But Bob was not so impressed.
When I first saw the film, I thought, "Oh, that ain't nothing." I said, "I saw a lot more than that." So I was kind of the bad guy.
So that was the first crack in their friendship. They hit the road with the film, trying to interest investors and maybe sell the story to Hollywood. But Bob says his heart wasn't in it. He had horses to take care of.
You know, there was a lot of disagreement right from the get-go. I said, "I got to go back to work and make a living."
Still, Roger and his associates continued the roadshow with one major difference.
They hired some guy that said he was me.
So, touring the country, making money with a Bob Gimlin impersonator.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that was it for Bob and Roger. Bob says the two never spoke again. That is, until Roger was on his deathbed.
His brothers called me and said, "Bob, he's asked to see you." So I went to see a little old dried-up guy there in a bed, and he rallied up a little bit and said, "Bob, oh, man, it's so good to see you." And I said, "Yeah, Rog." Bobby said, "I apologize." And I said, "Well, why did you hire a guy?" And he said, "It was me." "Well," he said, "we had to do something to get people to come in." And I said, "Well, dadgummit, Roger." He said, "Bob," he said, "I've got the money and the means and stuff now and the equipment." He said, "As quick as I get well, you and I are going to go back down there to California and capture Bigfoot." Well, that was in the afternoon, and he was dead the next morning.
Bob says he forgave Roger at that point. But still, he seethed that this had turned into a payday for others, but not for him.
My wife said, "Let's just get away from it, Bob. You went through so much over that, and it's bothered you a lot and made a different person out of you."
What did she mean by that, that it's made a different person out of you?
Well, I was a person that never held grudges against anybody. Now, once you're thinking about hurting somebody.
And Bob chafed at the mockery, the constant mockery that seemed to follow him wherever he went. When the ridicule reached his wife at her bank job, that was the breaking point.
they'd razz her about it in where she was working, and she'd come home a bawling and saying, "Oh God, Bob, I wish you'd have never went down there with Roger." And I said, "I do too."
So Bob disowned Bigfoot. He stopped doing interviews and answering mail about it.
I used to get really upset, but kept saying, "I keep my temper, keep my temper," trying to just stay away from it for that 35 years until Dimitri said, "I'm coming to the United States to have some time with you." Dmitry Baranov, a Russian scientist, one of the top Russian scientists, he said, "Well, if Bob can't make it to Russia, I'll come to the United States to have some time with him."
Baranov has written about Sasquatch, as well as its counterpart, what they call the Russian snowman. He came to the U.S. to attend a conference in California, and he convinced Bob Gimlin to go along with him. Reluctantly, Bob agreed to give a talk.
"And that's about all I can tell you about that short film footage and what happened."
He didn't know what to expect. For decades, his story had gotten nothing but ridicule.
"It's still in my mind real clear, but when I see it, probably going to be a different story."
It was like lifting a weight off my shoulders. Here's all these people just anxious to hear what went on and believed in me. And when I walked in the room, standing ovation. And I thought, now wait a minute, how did this turn around in a few days?
Not only was he accepted by this group of believers, he was revered. He was a rock star. He started going to Bigfoot conferences again, giving interviews again, signing autographs. But not everyone in Bob's life was on board, which partially explains why he and I are talking inside of a Jeep parked at his friend's farm and not at his place.
"My wife allows it, but she will not go to any of them with me because of the bad days that she had. She just says, I won't allow anybody that has anything to do with it to come to my place and do any filming or any interviews. You do what you want to, but I'm not going to go do any of it."
And that's sort of the agreement that Bob made with the world, too. He knows what he saw, and if you don't believe him, fine. You're the sucker.
I strongly believe if a real one walked in the house and sat down at a table, or the best it could, and they'd say, no, it's a fake, somebody in a suit. That's how naive they are. So that's just the way I tell them till the day they spank me in the face with dirt, you know.
It's Sound Effect from 88.5. Gabriel Spitzer here, and today we're telling stories of the last straw. So what do you do if you've hit your last straw and you realize something needs to change, but you're not the person who can change it? That's where Mary found herself. She asked that we don't use her last name in order to protect her grandchildren. Mary is married to a man with hoarding disorder, and it's pushed her to the breaking point. The thing is, her husband sees things very differently. Sound Effect's Janae Janik went to meet with Mary at a support group.
The support group meets every month in the basement of the Greenwood Senior Center in Seattle. Family members and loved ones of people with the disorder come together to better understand the condition and how to cope with it. Mary is worried that as her husband gets older, his habit of collecting and stashing old cars is going to cause problems.
"My concern is that if he dies before me, what do I do? I don't know where most of these cars are. And there might be 20, 30, 40 of them. I have no idea. Mm-hmm. I know where the ones are in our yard. Mm-hmm. I know where some are, where he has some friends. But there may be others that I have no idea about." Mm-hmm. "And he just gets angry if I bring it up." Mm-hmm. "Just gets angry. My husband has never had a car that isn't filled to the brim within a few days after he gets the car." Mm-hmm. "Because one of the things hoarders do is they'll see a bargain in something and they'll say, oh, I gotta have that. I might need it someday." And so they just accumulate and accumulate.
It's the someday syndrome.
Someday syndrome, yes.
My dad has the someday syndrome.
Someday syndrome, yeah. And so that's what I live with every day.
Mary and her husband have been married for over 50 years. They have kids and grandkids. There are now about 7 cars at their North Seattle house. There are a few in the driveway, looking past their prime. A couple more are parked in the front yard. An old gray Mercedes on the street. Mary says the accumulation happened gradually. She didn't really notice at first.
I think ever since we lived in this house, there's always been one car that just doesn't move. And he was going to use the parts or something. But it was like one car. And so I did not realize it at the time. And so it may be a cumulative thing. When you are retired, people need a hobby, you know. His hobby went into what I consider would be a hoarding disorder.
Mary didn't know how to deal with this on her own, and she didn't have much success talking about it with her husband. She says the support group has introduced her to other people going through the same thing, like Cindy, who struggled with trying to reason with her dad.
In his mind, everything is logical.
Yeah, it is.
So, like, you run out of counter space, right?
Yeah.
But it's like he'll leave a drawer open and put a cutting board on it to have another surface.
Yeah.
You know, he won't shut his cupboard doors because in his mind it's a waste of time to open and close your cupboard doors. I'm like, Dad, it only takes a second. He's like, but accumulative over time, it's a waste of time. I'm like, okay. It's like when we were cleaning his house and we were trying to clean out just in front of one of his vehicles, he had probably 20 empty water bottles that were just the square water bottles. And I said, Dad, what are you saving those for? He goes, I'm going to use them as planters. I'm like, okay, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, I'm going to cut them in half, fill them with dirt and plant stuff. I'm like, well, are you planning to plant anything? And he said, no. And I said, well, can we recycle them? He goes, no, because someday if I want to plant something, I want to have them. Yeah. He says, well, how about we recycle them? And if you decide you want to plant something, we'll go get you more water bottles or we'll buy you little planters. No, I can't get rid of them. It's like, Dad, can you throw out this pen? No, because it's white and it's 0.5 lead. And here's 0.5, here's 0.7, here's 0.9. This has an eraser, this doesn't. So he wants like one of everything so he'll have it in the event he needs it. I think the hardest part for me is, accepting it's not gonna go away.
Yeah. And it's gonna be a constant maintenance, but it's gonna be part of my life. Mm-hmm. Trying to help him.
Mm-hmm.
I have tissue in my pocket. So.
That's right.
And you can look at, I can look at my dad, and you see him as a smart adult. You're so smart. Why can't you figure this out?
Yeah.
Right? But then you have to step back and know him, the more I know about hoarding, right?
Mm-hmm.
They can't control it. They can't help it. It's just the way their brain is wired. And that's the hard part for me.
Mary has also realized this. She can't change her husband. No matter how simple it may seem to her, no one really needs this much stuff. She recognizes that for him, holding on to these things is much more complex.
And if it gives my husband some satisfaction, you know, at his age, some reward for him, I guess that's what he needs. And so since I can't do anything about it, I've just worked on being accepting and understanding and peaceful. Because, you know, life is struggle and problems and loss. And what I'm interested in now is being peaceful, finding joy, being grateful for what I have, creating an attitude of understanding how complex we all are. And knowing that this problem, yes, has created a lot of frustration in my life, but then weighing that against what has been positive as much as I can, yes.
So far, Mary's husband hasn't attended a support group. But Mary has come to understand that she's the one who needs the help right now. That sometimes all you can do is take care of yourself while supporting those you love.
That story from Sound Effects' Janae Janik. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Our theme today is The Last Straw. So, not to get too morbid here, but I imagine that all of us at one point or another have wondered how and when we are going to die. And on January 13th, 2018, people in the Hawaiian Islands got a message. Today is the day.
There was panic in paradise today. An accidental alert went out across Hawaii urging people to take shelter due to an incoming ballistic missile.
It was pandemonium in paradise after that alert was sent to phones throughout the state and broadcast on television. Shocked tourists and locals, worried they were minutes away from nuclear annihilation.
The false alarm was eventually called off, but not before Hawaiians and tourists started scrambling, even saying their goodbyes.
Former Seattleite Carl Badgley has some experience with emergencies. He's been an Army medic and worked as a 911 operator. But in search of a simpler, slightly less intense lifestyle, he had moved to be near the beautiful tropical waters off of Kona, Hawaii.
The thing about being on the water is where my happy place is and where I go pretty much every day driving the boat. You get turtles, you have great visibility, the water's warm, there's some sharks. Once in a while, you'll see a dolphin.
So that's where Carl found himself on January 13th, captaining his boat with his dive master and a handful of 20-something divers.
It was early. We left the dock about 7:30-ish, but it was a gorgeous day. I mean, there wasn't a cloud in the sky. Mauna Kea was out. Mauna Loa, you could see it. We could see Maui from where we were. So, I mean, it's one of those kind of dream days out there. And got to our mooring about 7:50 and hooked up. And once we settled down, we start the dive briefing. And while that briefing was going on, my phone alerted, the normal emergency broadcast type alert. So I climbed back up onto the helm and took a look at my phone and I read it. And then I read it again. And the alert said, ballistic missile threat inbound to Hawaii.
The U.S. Pacific Command has detected a missile threat to Hawaii. A missile may impact on land or sea within minutes. This is not a drill. If you are indoors, stay indoors. If you are outdoors, seek immediate shelter in a building.
Seek immediate shelter. Remain indoors. This is not a drill. So I interrupted the briefing and looked down at the four people that were down there and said, okay, guys, here's the deal. I'm going to read this to you, but I want you to listen to what I think about it, and then we'll make a decision. Now, my first thought was, well, North Korea has actually lost their minds. But here's the deal. Most likely, it's not a threat. It's not actually going to happen. Secondly, our military is pretty darn good, and they may shoot it down if it is real. Thirdly, North Korea doesn't have the accuracy to hit the islands. And I said, you know, the flight time of a ballistic missile is about 12 minutes from North Korea to Hawaii. We are more than 12 minutes away from the harbor. Once we got to the harbor, we were more than probably 12 minutes away from something that would resemble a shelter, realistic shelter from a nuclear blast. So here's my thought. Let's finish the dive plan. You guys go diving. You're going to be safer underwater anyway. And if I'm here when you get back, that's a good thing. And, you know, they looked a little concerned, but they all listened to the logic of what I was saying, and I think they understood that the reality is that we're probably not in any danger where we were. And they decided amongst themselves to go ahead and finish the briefing and go have a dive, and they had a great dive. They came back, and then a little while later, the cancellation came in.
Was there some part of you that was less certain?
You know, I look at it this way. There's a lot of things in life that we have the illusion that we can control. And there's a lot of things that we should realistically realize that we have zero control over. This is one of those second situations where we had zero control. If it had been a deadhead hit right on our boat, we wouldn't have known anyway. So to panic and worry about it is kind of futile. You know, I would rather go on the deck of a boat than hiding in a hole somewhere on an island.
Can you say a little bit more about how your background as a service member, as a medic, and as an emergency dispatcher, how that sort of helped shape the way that you reacted to this?
dealing with emergency situations on a daily basis, day in and day out, whether it's someone who, you know, is literally dying in your arms, or it's someone that calls up 911 and is panicked because they heard a noise and most likely it's nothing. You have to deal with all those situations the same. You have to have compassion. You have to have no emotion actually towards it, because you want to calm these people down, give them comfort, and do what you can to help them, whether it's their last moments or a brief bit of moments that are really fearful for them.
So given that obviously Hawaii was not vaporized, did you like go home at the end of the day like it was any other day, or do you feel like you took anything with you from it?
You know, that's a good question, because I got off the boat, said, hey, guys, have a great day. We probably said, I don't know exactly what, but we probably joked about, you know, the nuclear missile not hitting. And later that day, I had someone in my car, and, you know, she said, oh, I called my family and told them I love them. And, you know, I mean, a normal reaction for a majority of the people out there. And the funny thing is, it never crossed my mind that I should make that phone call. And I thought about that. I thought, wow, you know, is that bad of me? Is that good of me? And I don't think it's either way. Each person has to deal with those situations on their experiences and what they feel is best for them.
Is that the way you think? I mean, sorry to get all morbid, but is that the way you think about mortality generally?
No, I mean, God, I want to live forever, just like everybody, I think. I have a good life. The reality is, live your life well, live your life right, treat people well, treat people right. And at the end of the day, if it's over, it's over.
And if you did have a choice over where you spent your last moments, what do you think you would choose?
I think right where I was sitting. That's, you know, I mean, honestly, being out on the Pacific Ocean on the best island on the planet, probably the best place on the planet, you know, I mean, what more could I ask for? It's beautiful. My kids are in a place that they weren't going to get hurt anyway. So, you know, it's all good.
Seattle transplant Carl Badgley lives on the Big Island of Hawaii. All right, that's the last straw. Show over. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Shane Mailing, Tim Haywood, Lisa Cubbins, and Janae Janik. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. And before we leave behind the last straw thing, just a quick note to say that this is Posey's last show with us as a childless person. When she comes back to us in a few months, she'll be a jaded and sleep-deprived parent, just like me. Congratulations, Posey and Sarah. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast, and you can rate and review us on iTunes. You can also send your feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. And come on back next week when our theme is It's About Time. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.